I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Millions of people gathered in Rome today for the funeral of Pope John Paul II. Many more watched the event on television around the world. So many, in fact, that people are regarding this funeral as the largest religious event in modern history. This hour on The Connection, we're going to talk about the afterlife, the beliefs and superstitions we inherit, our secular fascination with the idea, and how our expectations come from religious paintings and writings, or events like the Pope's funeral.
We entrust our Pope John Paul to you, a mercy, most clement Father, a strong messenger of your word, a faithful dispenser of divine mysteries. Receive him, we ask, in the sanctuary of heaven, where with all your chosen, he may enjoy eternal glory.
Although belief in the afterlife is widely held, trying to figure out what it might be like remains one of civilization's great unanswered questions. So do you believe in life after death? If so, how do you picture it? Is heaven an actual place or a state of being? And why is it that we spend so many of our living moments wondering about that? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have with us today Carol Zaleski, who knows a great deal about these imponderable matters, like our quest for immortality, for example. She's professor of religion at Smith College and has written several books about heaven and the afterlife. Carol, it's nice of you to join us.
Thank you for having me.
And Jenna Rees is also with us. She's a religious historian, an author, and a reviewer of religious books for Publishers Weekly. She's joining us from Lexington, Kentucky. Jenna, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I would just like to hear from both of you your own thoughts on what happened earlier today in Rome. I'm still turning over in my mind all the sounds and the images of such an epic event as this funeral and what it tells us or how it is that it draws us back to that consideration of the afterlife. Carol, maybe you can start with that.
Well, it certainly seems to be an affirmation of belief in a heavenly afterlife and of hope for the life of the world to come, for eternal life. It seems to be an affirmation, in fact, of a popular acclamation of the current Pope, John Paul II, the now deceased Pope, as a saint. Perhaps you saw the signs that said Santo Subito and people chanting Giovanni Paolo Santo. So at the same time, they were praying for the soul of John Paul II, and in a sense preparing to, if not already, praying to him to intercede for them in heaven.
Jenna, what
that seems to be remarkable.
Yeah. Jenna?
Yes, well, like many Americans, I TiVo'd the funeral but have not watched it yet, so you know I will be doing that later on today. So I can't comment on the funeral, but certainly the media coverage and the widespread interest in what has happened with the Pope and what will happen with the Catholic Church reveals this kind of enduring interest that Americans have in particular in spiritual questions.
The prayer, the singing, the ritual that is involved in a funeral, even on a scale like this. I mean, Carol, you say that it is praying for, you know, the Pope to intercede on people's behalf, but what is it that people are praying for at a funeral like this? Is it for the Pope to find comfort in an afterlife? Is it for measuring the quality of the afterlife? Because that doesn't seem to be much in question.
Well, I actually did get up at 4 this morning and watch the whole thing, and I was very struck by one of the prayers that was sung by a group of Eastern Rite patriarchs. These are they're Roman Catholic, but they're in the Eastern Rite. They're Catholic in communion with Rome, and they gathered to sing a prayer for the dead, which was also found in the Orthodox Church in the liturgy for the dead. And they prayed for to God to grant to the soul of your departed servant John Paul to rest in a place of light, in a place of happiness, in a place of peace, where there is no pain, no grief, no sighing. And I thought that was a beautiful depiction of what they were petitioning for their beloved pontiff, to go to this place which they were visualizing as a kind of garden of light and peace.
And Jenna, the visualizing of heaven, the idea of where one might be in an afterlife, that's a pretty important part of it, isn't it, when you look back in history?
Yes, it is, definitely. And when we think about a funeral, I've attended to two funerals just in the last 6 weeks, so this is very much on my mind. I think that when we are part of a funeral, we are wondering as we sit there, why are we here? Is this funeral for us, the living, or is it in fact to usher this person into the realm to come? And I think it's a combination of both of those factors, but primarily it is for the living. It's for those of us left behind.
Do you mean it as a form of comfort for the people to
yes.
know that the farewell, the grief is somehow tempered by that understanding that, you know, maybe you'll see that person again?
Exactly. It is a reaffirmation of belief, no matter what religious tradition you happen to be a part of the beliefs of that tradition, and a comfort that perhaps there is the possibility that you will see that person again, that much-loved individual will be part of your life in the life to come.
It's interesting.
Yeah, I think I would say that, too.
Go ahead, Carol.
I would emphasize that. Yeah, I'm sorry. I would emphasize the social character of it. We heard, again, at the Pope's funeral, the litany of the saints, the name, the roll call of the saints being called out as the soul of John Paul was being commended to join them. And there was a great, of course, the huge crowds there. There was a great sense of a massive gathering that was taking place on earth and also in heaven simultaneously, as if what was going on in St. Peter's Square was mirroring a heavenly festival.
Carol, in different parts of the world, the people who do public opinion polls are measuring a drift away from the sort of firm Orthodox doctrine of religion. Are we seeing a drift away from a belief in heaven or the afterlife at the same time?
Well, belief in heaven seems to be at a very high level. The polls I've seen say 70% to 80% of people believe in heaven.
That's more people than go to church, isn't it?
Way more people than go to church or that would say they believe in hell. So, and it, in some ways, our beliefs in heaven have changed and have become sentimentalized, perhaps. There's more emphasis on family reunions and less on meeting the Lord and Judge. But in one form or another, belief in heaven is a pretty hearty perennial.
Now there's something strange about that, because that's, in fact, not what most churches, most religious leaders teach, this notion that you're going to somehow see your parents again or you know, long-dead pets will come back and be a part of your afterlife. Am I wrong about that?
Well, that depends. I think there is in many traditions this idea of something like the communion of saints, and sainthood is something to which every person is called. It's not just an elite group that gets together up there in heaven, but mm-hmm. in fact is meant to be everybody. The Pope John Paul II himself used to say that he liked to think of hell as empty. Not that it doesn't exist, but mm-hmm. maybe that through the divine mercy there are ways in which all sorts of people find themselves in that communion of saints.
I'm wondering, Janet, to what extent our own thoughts about heaven are colored by what Hollywood has done with the spotlight from the sky and that those sorts of images.
Well, certainly there's been a recent spate of Hollywood films in the last decade that have analyzed heaven, everything from What Dreams May Come with Robin Williams, if you saw that film, to Defending Your Life, where Meryl Streep watches her whole life on a large video screen and has to be accountable for the choices that she made. Certainly, I think we are very influenced by these kinds of films. You know, Carol said something interesting a moment ago. There is this large proportion of Americans who report a belief in heaven. A Newsweek poll recently put it at 76%, which is higher than it was 20 years ago when it was about 71%. But when you break that down and you ask Americans specific questions about what heaven will be like, then the numbers are much, much lower. You know, people who are asked, do you believe that you will have responsibilities in heaven? Only 19% say that they will. Less than half of people assume that they will see their friends, relatives, or spouses, which kind of surprised me, actually. So there seems to be a fuzziness about what heaven will actually be like, even though most people profess a belief in heaven.
How do you make sense of that?
Well, I think it hits upon what you just mentioned, that there's not much teaching about this officially from religious institutions. The idea of heaven is certainly current in popular theology, and you'll find all kinds of books that speculate about what heaven will be like. And that's a tradition that extends back to the 19th century. One of the best-selling novels of the 19th century was a woman named Elizabeth Stuart Phelps, who wrote a book called The Gates Ajar. This was shortly after the Civil War, and the main character is speculating what has happened to my brother who died in the war. And that novel sold nearly 200,000 copies in America and England, which was an astonishing figure for the time. So, for the popular level, this is a very, very interesting topic and question.
It was also a time, if I'm not mistaken, when people believed, or perhaps even through that book, caught onto this idea that heaven would have some of or many of the creature comforts that are part of a good life on earth too, right?
Yes, exactly. In fact, in The Gates Ajar, you see her entering this house, which is very much a Victorian gingerbread cottage. There's a dog sunning itself on the front porch. There's a piano in the parlor. I mean, all of the accoutrements of Victorian life are there. They're present.
And yet when you listen to the way it is spoken of in churches and in funerals, you hear about a state of being. You don't hear about the parlor. So, connection listeners, what do you believe about an afterlife? Is there one? And if there is one, is it something that you can imagine, or does it have to be a mystery? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Carol Zaleski is with us this hour. She is a professor of religion at Smith College and author of a couple of books. The Book of Heaven, The Book of Hell is being written right now, Carol tells us, and another one called Life of the World to Come. Jana Reese is also with us. She is a religious historian and works as religion book review editor for Publishers Weekly. We'll get a chance to talk a little bit later in the program about the number of books that wrestle with this and have over the ages. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's keep this fairly basic and fairly simple. Let's talk about your understandings, your belief, what you've been taught, and what you think of an afterlife. We're going to go to Milton, Massachusetts for our first call. Chris is with us. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Sure. I guess my question, first of all, is I have a son that died over 6 years ago, and I, had, of course, a lot of questions about where he might be or how he still exists now. And I remember going to this, a couple of years after he died, going to a philosophy workshop at Boston College. I'm very Catholic and Christian. And I had asked him, I pulled him aside and said, do you believe in an afterlife? And he said, well, I want you to think about the question. He seemed to be saying, he said, there's a problem with your question.
Did he explain what the problem with your question was?
No, he just left me to ponder the question. And I, typical, I guess, philosophical kind of, way to leave me. But, I guess is what their thoughts might be on that. I mean, the one thing I kind of wonder is if there's a problem with the way it's asked, like before and after. We're kind of stuck in a time, and it's beyond our imagination to think of, how the heaven might be part of the earth right now. And, it's not like we have to wait. It's, it's an excuse for not doing something now or recognizing.
Can I ask you, Chris, though, if the philosophers or the Jesuits or the religious people backed off on the question, what does that leave you with? What do you think about an afterlife or your son? Do you fill all that in with your imagination?
I guess it has challenged my idea of what heaven is, because I now think that heaven, I don't want it to be something that doesn't include the body. I feel like it must be so awesome and beyond our imagination, but it's got to be part of this world. It has to be part of this physical world in some way. It must transform it in some way that I can't understand.
Or part of what our understanding of a physical world is, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Carol, what do you think?
Well, it sounds like you're really speaking to the resurrection faith of Christians and Jews and Muslims, those who say that the world that God created is not destined simply to vanish and leave behind disembodied spirits, but was destined for some perfection, that we look forward to the perfect and embodied existence of the resurrected life, and not just to a spiritual afterlife in heaven. I think that sometimes academically trained theologians and philosophers are reluctant to talk about any kind of hope for an afterlife, though, simply because they've absorbed some of the secular critique of it, and they worry that it might distract from our care and concern for this world.
Is there a space for belief in an afterlife, Carol, though, in most of the major world religions?
Yes, I think it's a feature of all the developed world religions, and it exists in germinal form in the most ancient traditions, which are not always terribly explicit about their vision of a heavenly afterlife. I think all world religions, indeed all world cultures, have some conception of a way in which life transcends death and is not defeated by death. And the details vary, of course, but I would say that's a universal.
Would it be equally universal to say that the space for that belief in the afterlife in all different cultures comes basically from the same question, and that is people on earth saying, is this all there is?
Right. That's right. And it isn't just a matter of wanting individuals to continue existing. In fact, we don't necessarily want a continued temporal existence like the kind we have now. We want some idea of a transformed existence, as your caller was saying. But there's certain ideals that we are committed to that we like to think have lasting, enduring value that are not defeated by death.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Charlotte, Vermont, and Anime is joining us. Anime, thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning. My point is twofold. One is I think we, the finality of death is so awful to us that we have to imagine that there's something else. And then the other thing is, we cannot imagine not being, you know, just as we cannot imagine nothingness. And so that's why we invent something else after. I think all of nature dies. Every living creature, every tree, every bug, everything lives and dies. If we have soul and afterlife, everything else has soul and afterlife.
And do you believe that's the case?
No, no. I believe we are part of a large life cycle. We are in this little band of brightness for a little while, and then we go back totally non-existent. Our molecules, our atoms, our energy become part of other energies, and we as conscious beings, that's the end of us.
So I was wondering as you were talking, Anime, if you were going to go to a kind of a form of reincarnation
No. I will not exist anymore. What's left of me is a little bit of genetic materials, a couple of trees that I planted for a while, and that's it.
You know, I was reading something, Jenna, in an article recently about someone, and Anime, I thank you for the call because it reminded me of this, who had some scientist take the DNA of a dead relative and have it put into an actual tree. So there was some way of saying that something kept living. That just seems so powerful. It's such a powerful motivator for people. Do you know what I mean?
Definitely. And that's a fascinating example of our deep desire to have something continue. And the previous caller mentioned this as well, her desire that heaven would actually be bodily, that it would be an embodied experience. And I think certainly anyone who has lost someone, and particularly someone who has lost a child that she once held in her arms, that sense that the afterlife does need to continue in an embodied existence is very strong. Now, Anime's question is, you know, do we invent the belief in the afterlife in order to comfort ourselves so that this continues? I mean, of course, that's an unanswerable question. People from various religious traditions have deep-seated beliefs that this is actually quite real, but for many people, that's not an operating belief, and Her theory is a little bit unusual in that she is using this idea that we actually return to kind of a generic energy. And in America in particular, because we're such a highly individualistic society, we tend to have a much more individualistic idea of the soul's journey after death.
Is that in part because in this country you can take a little bit of, you know, whatever we may have read about the Tibetan Book of the Dead and mix that together with whatever we were taught in synagogue or Sunday school and come up with our own little version?
Yes, we are very eclectic in our spiritual development, and I think increasingly so through the decades. Certainly since the 1960s, Americans have felt increasingly comfortable with mixing. I mean, it's called cafeteria spirituality because you're standing in line at the cafeteria and you take one thing from one tradition and then you take a main course from, you know, something else and then maybe a dessert from something else, and you mix it together in your own unique way.
Carol, I wanted to just come back before we leave the cafeteria image of what's available from different religions, because it's my understanding that some Buddhists, Buddhism is one, Judaism is another, where there is a reluctance to sort of wholeheartedly embrace the idea of an afterlife. Am I wrong about that?
I think sometimes we hear that. Very often we're hearing from people whose version of Judaism or of Buddhism, as the case may be, is influenced by modern agnosticism about the afterlife. And I think there's a big difference between the sparseness of discussion of the afterlife in the sources of ancient Judaism and a decision after the full flowering of a belief in the afterlife, a decision to back away from it, has a very different character and different consequences. In ancient Judaism, as in the other cultures of the ancient Near East, there is a sense that heaven is the place where God is, and that and when you die, you go into the underworld, and you live on in memory and through your children. And there isn't much said, in fact, in the Old Testament about life after death. But there is a seed of hope for a life that is not destroyed by death. It appears in the Book of Daniel, and it developed in later and in classical rabbinic Judaism, where you get the development of the hope for the resurrection of the dead and a heavenly afterlife, kind of mixed together, those two models, very similar to what you find in Christianity. So for a Jewish person who is really rooted in the classical rabbinic Jewish tradition, belief in an afterlife is a very important thing, and it's reflected in the prayer book, the daily prayer book that Jews use. For Buddhism, it's a very interesting case. Traditionally, Buddhists believe that there are six realms in which you can be reborn at death, and heaven is one of them. There's a heavenly realm filled with perfume and light and flowers and bliss. The only problem with it is that it's temporary. You will fall away from that realm, too, and have to work out your path to awakening until such time as you no longer have to be reborn. Now, that's a very different model. So if you're standing in a cafeteria and picking and choosing from various conceptions of the afterlife, you might have trouble combining that model with a Western-derived idea of an eternal life to be enjoyed in heaven. Those two don't fit together.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Do you believe in an afterlife? Do you like to talk about the afterlife, or is that something that you find intensely personal, something that you've constructed in your own head and something you're not really keen about sharing? Let's go to Barrington, Rhode Island for our next call. Joanne's with us. Hi, Joanne.
Hi.
Tell me
Thanks
what you're thinking.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, you're most welcome.
I was just listening carefully to the verbs that a lot of people, the call-ins, as well as your guests, were using. Desire, want, would like to think, invention. I really feel that the idea of an afterlife is wish fulfillment. It's a desire to kind of explain what we're all curious about because we don't know. And I think it's built into human ego. We just can't accept the fact that this world that we've been so involved in multiple ways, that there's going to be an end to it.
It's funny, though, Joanne, because when you read about this, a lot of the teaching says that the ego that would want an afterlife is actually one of the things that disappears in the afterlife.
Exactly, exactly. It's Santa Claus to me. It's the idea that, human behavior needs to be controlled and needs to have some order. And so it's a nice story that puts people into a format for not so much civil order as a kind of next realm.
But don't you let your own imagination go there sometimes? I mean, I take from what you're saying that you're not much of a believer of this Santa Claus idea. But I can't help but think that there must be times when you wonder.
Oh, curiosity is always there, but there's no model for this. I mean, it's very common for humans to think we're the only planet with Earth, or with life as we know it. I mean, given what the world quantity, the universe, the cosmic quantity is, that doesn't seem to be logical in the numbers. And yet that's, I think, a profound human, again, based on ego. We're the only ones around.
But Jenna, think about this. If we were to find some way of proving or disproving this and discover that there isn't an afterlife, what do we do with funerals? What do we do with mourning? What do we do? That's mourning. All those rituals that come at the end of life are all in some way, aren't they, Jenna, connected to ideas or curiosity about what comes after?
Absolutely. In fact, how we do our funerals, how we dress our dead, how we bury our dead, all of those things reveal what we hope or think about the afterlife. I think Joanne raises a really interesting point, which is that throughout history, people have tended to project their own desires onto the afterlife. And if you, I'm sure that Dr. Zaleski could address this very well, much better than I can. But, for example, 2,000 years ago, Christians spoke quite often about heaven being a place where the streets were paved with gold. And if you read contemporary popular literature about heaven, that's just not an image that you see anymore. Why is that? It's probably because we live in the richest society that has ever graced the face of the earth. It's not something we dream about. What we do dream about, though, is heaven as a place of eternal rest and of eternal bliss. I have a book here. It's a recent popular book called A Travel Guide to Heaven. This is published by Doubleday. It's by a man named Anthony DeStefano. He says that heaven is bursting with excitement and action. It's the ultimate playground created purely for our enjoyment by someone who knows what enjoyment means because he invented it. It's Disney World, Hawaii, Paris, Rome, and New York all rolled up into one, and it's forever.
What's heaven the idea of a sort of Six Flags
vacation.
Heaven?
Exactly. Well, when you think about it, what is the one thing that we as contemporary Americans feel that we lack? It's time. It's time and it's rest. And so that is what I see being emphasized now.
Would you agree with that, Carol, that heaven is our idea of what it is we don't have on earth?
Yeah, I think, John, I just put that just beautifully. I completely agree with that. And I think it points to another reason why this is a fascinating subject, regardless of whether you believe in an afterlife or not. Our ideas about heaven are a very good index of what we regard as the highest good. And you can learn a lot about a culture by looking at what it's projecting up there onto the dome of the sky, what image of the best society, of the most desirable environment, whether it's a sort of pastoral nature kind of garden image or a cosmopolitan city image or this Six Flags image, which to me is more like a vision of hell than of heaven. It still tells us a lot about ourselves.
1-800-423-8255. What is your idea of the afterlife? And what do our ideas of the afterlife tell us about society today? We'd like to hear from you. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And this hour we are talking about the afterlife, ideas about the afterlife, your ideas, our ideas, if there is even an afterlife. Carol Zaleski and Jana Reese are with me on the program. We'd like to hear from you. 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Buffalo, New York. Alice is joining us. Hi, Alice. How are you?
Hi, Dick. I love your voice.
Thank you.
I'm 89 years old. I have no idea of what it's going to be like after I die. I'm not concerned about it. I think the important, and I've gone to church all my life. Religion is confusing. But I think the important thing is what we make of the life we have here and now with ourselves and helping others to do so.
I wonder, Alice, at times if our sort of hyperventilating about the afterlife isn't a way of avoiding exactly what you're talking about. If things, you know, if we can't make this life on Earth the way we'd like it, then it's easier, more comforting to think about an afterlife.
I think that's true. I think this is how religions develop, to make people think if it's so bad here, it'll be better if you just hang in there and believe certain things. I think religion and science are both seeking the truth. They both have the same goal, but most religions have closed minds, mine own including. I'm a Christian, I think, even though I don't believe in some of what it tells me.
So when you allow yourself to imagine, what do you think about life after death, or do you think about that?
Not much. In fact, the shape the world's in right now, I'm starting to think, geez, I'm going to be out of here pretty soon, and I hope somebody figures it out. I've worked hard to be the best person I can be. I haven't worked at it. I think I've picked up ideas lots of places. I think we get a lot of misinformation. And I think it's the extremists in religion who are causing all the trouble, the ones that think they're the only ones that are right. I believe in a God, but I think he's much broader than most religions conceive of him, her, it.
Who was that? Was that Carol?
Oh, that was me. I was just
was
responding.
Yeah,
no, great delight.
Tell me what you're thinking.
First of all, I think I'd like to take that slogan, religion is confusing, and put it on a bumper sticker in my office because it would explain a whole lot of the things that I deal with in my day-to-day job. Yes, I think, you know, Alice made a really good point, which is that to some degree, all of the speculation about heaven becomes fruitless, or hell for that matter, you know, the afterlife in general, because the focus ought to be this world, improving this world, and what we can do to serve others in this world. And I think she's on the right track, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Could I jump in there?
By all means,
I'm hearing a couple of very important criticisms being expressed of belief in an afterlife. One has to do with this idea that it's a, as Freud would say, a compensatory fantasy, and that it's all about wish fulfillment. And the other point, which the caller just made so well, is that it distracts us from trying to make this world a better place. But Dick, I think you made a point earlier which speaks to the first criticism. That is, you pointed out that however you conceive of an afterlife, it really costs you a death. That is to say, a lot of what we're attached to and a lot of what our ego craves is not, in fact, satisfied by any of the major conceptions of an afterlife, except perhaps for the Six Flags version. But most versions of an afterlife do involve a considerable amount of sacrifice and portray the reward in heaven as the culminating of a life of self-giving, of self-sacrifice. You can see this actually if you read the Pope's Testament that was just published, where he talks about how he's looking towards his death and just wanting to give himself as much as he can to the service of his church. So he wants to not wait for that big pie in the sky, but in fact, his very hope for heaven is part of what inspires his effort and self-sacrifice here below. And I think that's a principle that you find in all religions, that there's a direct relationship between the belief and hope for a heavenly afterlife and the inspiration of moral effort in this life.
But
whether it's wish fulfillment, that's, I suppose I haven't totally answered that
no,
question.
No, but wait a second here, because there's something else that you've reminded me of that you were talking to one of my colleagues about here that I want to try and test because I don't quite get it. You were saying that our ancestors, pretty uniformly, those who believed in the afterlife, feared hell. That was what they were taught. That's what they did. And that people today, there are people today who actually fear heaven. What is that about?
Well, I think there is a sense that heaven, however you portray it, is just a bit beyond what we can really imagine. So it is the unknown. Even if it's an unknown that on one level you long for, still, it would be frightening to imagine being transformed into another kind of life, very different from the one we now are somewhat familiar with.
One of the things I was wondering about, Jenna, is if that fear has anything to do with not being able to imagine a life of eternal bliss and eternal grace and eternal happiness, almost as if all that would get boring after a while.
Well, actually, it's funny that you should mention that, because I had an experience once when I was working at a Protestant church of, you know, teaching the senior high youth, and one of them made this comment that basically indicated that he didn't want to go to heaven because it just sounded so deadly dull. You know, strumming harps for all eternity is not going to turn on a teenage boy. So, you know, he was asking me, why would I want to do this? And I think it's a fair question if that's what heaven is like, but I think that's probably a very limited conception of what heaven could possibly be like.
No, you can call me shallow. I don't mind that.
I didn't mean that. I meant
No, but it is that, isn't it? I mean, really, when you think, oh, you know, we don't get to gossip in heaven. We don't get any of the you know, the little barbs that make life interesting, Carol, like across the dinner table, that sort of thing.
Well, I would think that it's part of the definition of heaven that it cannot be boring. So by definition, it can't be boring. So if you've constructed a view of heaven that has any potential to bore you, then either you've got to change your view of heaven, or you've got to expect that we will be changed. Like, you know, in the Divine Comedy, Dante has to eat a particular herb to change him, to transhumanize him. He had to coin a new verb for this, so that he would be fit for the endless delights of heaven and not be bored by them. So boredom is, you know, it's in the eyes of the beholder, but it definitely isn't part of any picture of heaven that's worth its salt.
Let's go back to our callers, to Sudbury, Massachusetts, and Pikash is joining us. Hi, Pikash.
Hi. Thank you, first of all, for a wonderful program and the opportunity to speak. I would like to give you a perspective from the Upanishads. These are the most sacred books of ancient India. According to Upanishads, heaven and hell are not physical places hidden somewhere in the universe. They are states of mind. So there's a story in the Upanishad where a king invites a sage for a dialogue on spiritual matters. And sage asks the king a question. Do you know where you will go after you die? And a long dialogue follows, and the sage tells the king that you really cannot go anywhere where you have not already been. So think about Pope John Paul, for example. He was already there in heaven with his state of mind, you know, the serenity of his thought, the nobility of his actions. He was already there in heaven. So if we want to go to heaven, we have to realize it here in this life, in this world.
But Bikash, wasn't there somebody not long ago who made an attempt to do this long television miniseries based on the Upanishads to try and give some kind of visual representation to it?
Well, I don't know, but see, here there are 108 Upanishads, and people have different interpretations of them. I'm talking about the biggest, Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, where the sage is Yajnavalk, and the most powerful king of North India, Janak, who is also a very learned person, invites him for the dialogue. The essence of the dialogue is this. Whatever imagery we have is unimportant.
Yeah.
The concept of heaven and hell, they're really states of mind, and we have to see them right here before we go anywhere from here.
I'm glad you called.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot. 1-800-423-8255. Where are we going next? Fall River, Massachusetts. Bill's on the line. Hi, Bill.
Hi there. Well, I'm a funeral director down here in Fall River, and I was listening to your discussions about the cafeteria style of religious practice in this country. And from my point of view, in just observing the groups of people that find themselves gathering in my place of business to deal with death and afterlife and whatnot, they are becoming more and more varied as time goes by. If you go back 50 years, you had the French community, you had the Polish community, you had the Portuguese community. They were rather separate, and they had their own set of values and ideas, and they were able to sustain them. But now we find ourselves in my place of business interacting with people from many, many traditions and many, many ideas. And so at some point, in order to allow for that group to gather and for that group to communicate, you by necessity have to begin to open yourself up to other possibilities.
And so in your job, listening to all those different ideas of what the afterlife might represent, has it changed your own idea of what it is?
Well, it's changed everything, really, everything that I do, because it becomes so necessary for us, even on a very basic level, to help people communicate what's going on well for that person in this world. There is not that sense of community that allows people to gather quickly and communicate and share ideas about who somebody was, mm-hmm. nor where they've been. And so, yeah, it's a challenge of facilitation and of openness and of sharing, and how do we get people to gather and understand each other. It's very interesting.
It's a great point that you make, and Jen, it takes us back to somewhere we were earlier in the program where we were talking about, is this all for the person who has died, or is this for the people who are alive? And having been recently to a couple of funerals, you'll know what Bill's talking about when he talks about those rare, those sort of decreasing opportunities that we have to get together.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point. I think, you know, for one thing, Bill, I had not thought of the funeral home as a laboratory for religious pluralism, but of course that's what it must be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a really brilliant observation, that this is kind of the front lines of how religion is changing in America, the diversity of religion in America. And as for the funeral, again, who is this for? And I return to that original statement that the funeral really is for those of us who are left behind and trying to make sense of this within the context of community.
Carol, does religion, has religion always made a direct connection between community on earth and the community of souls that is so much a part of Christianity?
Well, it's certainly a recurrent idea. The gentleman who was speaking earlier, quoting from the Upanishads, is coming out of a tradition in which the earliest idea of the afterlife was of being joined to the world of the fathers. And it was thought that when you cremate the dead and they rise up in the smoke like incense and they go up to be gathered to the fathers, that's a very common idea, fathers and mothers perhaps, that you are incorporated into the community of your ancestors who went before you when you die is one model for the afterlife that you find all over the world. Mm. So it is, I think, very often a social and sociable idea.
1-800-423-8255. Raleigh, North Carolina is next. Chuck's on the line. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, Dick. Thank you. I wanted to say, as a counterbalance to those that speak of heaven or the afterlife as wish fulfillment or
yeah.
projection or an invention, that just speaking, I'm informed by my Christian faith, but leaving out all religious abstracts and just speaking about human experience, it would seem to me that the human experience, that all of humanity, for the most part down through the years, has intuited the idea of an afterlife would be like evidence that there is such a thing, just as we hunger for food or grasp for air or wish for love or wish for beauty. The fact that we wish for it, I think there is such a thing as beauty. The fact that we hunger to be loved means there is such a thing as love, even though both of them can be explained in purely scientific terms or biological terms, but when we experience it, we know it. Just like I know recently they say there's another planet, and we have not yet seen it, but there's great evidence that it exists. And so that type of thinking brings me many times back to my religious roots.
Why is it that the persistence of the belief makes it more true? Could not someone just turn it around, Chuck, and say, well, you say it's true because it's never been disproven, but I say it's not true because it's never been proven. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do what you mean, and I just simply have to live with that tension. I think it's kind of like having been loved. I remember having experienced intense love at one time in my life, and then when that love was, after many years, I went through a great deal of pain, and then I thought there was no such thing as love until I was once again loved again. And
right.
so And then, because there are people listening right now that would not believe there's such a thing as love. And anyway, I cannot, just like you said, I would not even try to disprove for someone that there is no such thing if they are intent on making that negative comment. I would just simply suggest they consider the positive affirmation I'm having its ground in human experience.
Chuck, I'm glad you called, because what you've done is sort of given us one other plane here at the end of the program, which we've not really given enough time to. And Carol, that is that this is a very emotional thing, not just an intellectual exercise.
Right. I think that was a good, what might be called an argument from desire for the reality of life after death,
which gives it, in many ways, more power than the intellectual argument, doesn't it?
I would think so, because it speaks to something that's very deep-seated in a sense of who we are. And if we mistrust the deepest sources of who we are, we're going to end up mistrusting a lot that's important to us, and not just losing track of some particular fantasy we may have about the afterlife. We're going to lose track of our whole reason for living.
What do you think, Jana?
Well, I hope that I haven't given the impression that I am sitting in an ivory tower somewhere and that I don't hold these beliefs myself, or that I ridicule them in any way, because
I
am a strong
so.
Believer in the afterlife.
Yeah.
And as a person of faith, I do think, however, that our projections of some elements of our culture onto the afterlife is definitely worthy of study, because how we think about the specifics of the afterlife is culturally conditioned.
But that's in many ways why it's so powerful, is that it has all those intellectual aspects, Jana, but...
And the emotional,
and
right.
the emotion, yeah.
Exactly.
Well, fascinating stuff. I thank you both for being with me. Jana, it was nice to have you on the program.
Thank you very much.
Jana Reese is a religious historian and religion book editor for Publishers Weekly. And Carol Zaleski, thanks a lot for your time as well.
Thank you. And I definitely agree with what Jana just said. So enjoyed the conversation very much.
Carol is a professor of religion at Smith College, author of The Book of Heaven and Life of the World to Come. Our program is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, Doug Sugertz, and Mary Stack. We had help from Sarah Baker, Annie Hopengarten, and Patrick Kiker. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.